Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us on this kind of windy and chilly Saturday. Bit of a change from last week, that's for sure. Only there are less drunk people wearing green running around outside the studio this week, so I'll take it. My friends, we have so much to discuss today on the Business Lunch show. We're going to be talking about the Weight Watchers app that is getting Oprah a lot of blame, but is also getting Weight Watchers sued because there's lots of technical glitches and lots of stuff going on with that app. You're going to want to stick around for that. We're also talking about the zombie real estate projects that are all over the city, just kind of sitting there with lots of questions around them. And we're going to be talking about restaurants and that auto gratuity that gets put on checks when you have a lot of people in your party. So we're going to be talking about that. But right now we're joined by Emily Badger. She's from Washington Post Wonk Blog, which is a great, great destination. I'm a big fan. I encourage you all to read that regularly. There was a really interesting piece that caught my eye, and it was all about buying diapers, which seems like a pretty innocuous thing to do that a lot of people do. But in fact, there's a lot of issues tied up with class and economics and privilege with the simple act of just buying diapers. And so as we look at that, there was so much kind of conversation going around there that, in fact, also there was a follow story of that on Wonk Blog. So joining us now is Emily Badger. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Amy. It's great to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, so take us through this story, because I think we think of the act of buying diapers as just kind of like buying toilet paper, no big deal. But in fact, there are a lot of really interesting issues surface, particularly around class, when we start talking about the simple act of buying diapers. Take us through that.
Right. So buying diapers is like buying toilet paper in that if you have a baby, you buy tons of it. You can't do without it. You're constantly going to the store to buy it. But unlike a lot of other sort of basic hygiene things that you need to stock up in your home, diapers are really expensive. You know, they're not expensive per unit. A single diaper might cost between, you know, about 20 and 40 cents a piece. But when you have a baby and you're putting 25 diapers on them a day, this stuff really adds up over time and can become quite expensive. You know, for a lot of families, we're probably talking about spending maybe about $80 a month on diapers per baby. And so if you're a low-income parent, you know, $80 a month or, you know, what could be as much as like $1,000 a year is a tremendous amount of money to be spending on diapers. And, you know, there's some federal government data that suggests that families in the bottom quintile of households in America, families that make the least amount of money, spend about 14% of their income on diapers. And that's just a crazy amount of money when you think about the income that you should be spending on food, on rent, on all kinds of other things. And, you know, the issue that I was writing about, and this came up because the White House is trying to do something about this, is that diapers are like the one basic necessity that poor families who have children have to have that no federal anti-poverty program helps you pay for. So you can't spend food stamps to buy diapers. You don't get diapers through Medicaid. You don't get diapers if you get special nutrition assistance for mothers and infants. You know, this is sort of this incredibly expensive cost that we don't put a whole lot of thought into, that we sort of abandon poor families to pay for on their own. And, you know, none of that is a new phenomenon. Diapers have been expensive for poor families for a really long time. But part of the reason why the White House is interested in this now, and why I think it's so interesting, is that, you know, diapers have actually become less expensive than they've ever been before if you are a middle class or a wealthy person. And that's because, you know, you could get an Amazon Prime membership. You could have them shipped to you in bulk on 48 hours notice. You could get a Costco membership and buy them much cheaper. But all of those things that I just mentioned, you know, Costco memberships, Amazon memberships, buying in bulk, those are things that are unavailable to poor people. So while the economy is creating all of these opportunities to make diapers cheaper, the very people who need the savings the most aren't able to access them.
Which is so interesting. I think, you know, a very important piece to consider that in order to take advantage of ordering things in bulk, say on Amazon Prime, that's, I think an Amazon Prime membership is about $100 a year. And then you have to have a device, you have to have internet service, you have to have all these things, you know, you have to have a credit card on file to do those things. That there's things that are, in fact, quite out of reach for a lot of people that are in a lower income bracket. And so this triggered some degree of backlash, I suppose, which caused you to write a sort of a follow piece to this on the Wonk blog that was all about cloth diapers, which I think was really interesting because as I started reading this, I immediately thought, you know what? I bet people are going to go nuts about cloth diapers, but there's a lot of privilege attached to that too.
Right. Well, I guess it wasn't surprising. I mean, the initial reaction that I heard to writing about this was, you know, a couple different things. You know, there were, of course, people who just said, you know, poor people shouldn't be having babies in the first place if they can't afford to put diapers on them. There were people who were very sort of offended by the idea that the federal government should help poor people pay for diapers. And then there were the people who said, why don't they just use cloth diapers? You just have to pay for them once. You reuse them. You wash them over and over again. You don't have to go to the store to be constantly buying diapers. And when so many people said that to me, I thought, like, oh, this is like a classic example of people sort of coming up with a middle-class solution for poor people. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, what do you really need if you're going to do cloth diapers? First of all, you have to have a lot of money up front to buy them in the first place. You have to have a lot of free time in order to do all of the labor that's involved in washing them. And you have to have a washing machine. And, you know, quite a lot of low-income households and renter households in America do not have washing machines. I mean, we don't think of a washing machine as a luxury appliance in America. But when I went back and looked at some census data, in fact, you know, about one in four families in America who live on less than about $40,000 a year do not have a washing machine at home. You know, if you look at families who are even poorer than that, they're even less likely to have a washing machine at home. So now, you know, are we talking about asking poor single mothers to, you know, drag dirty cloth diapers to a laundromat where maybe the laundromat's going to frown on you putting dirty diapers in a washing machine that's shared with lots of other people? I mean, they're just all of these reasons why, you know, you have to think through that a little more to ask whether or not this is really a solution that fits into the life of a poor person.
Right. I've seen those up at laundromats and at apartment, you know, shared laundry facilities. It'll say things like, don't dye anything in this washer. Don't use cloth, you know, don't wash cloth diapers, don't wash pillows or rugs. There's just certain things they just don't want in shared washers. So there's that too to consider. Well, it is really interesting. And so who is doing something about this? Is anybody kind of actively trying to troubleshoot this in a legislative way?
So that's part of why I was writing about this, particularly right now, is that the White House announced this initiative about 10 days ago now, where what they would ideally like, I think, is to make some changes to anti-poverty programs, which you would have to use Congress in order to do, in order to say, you know, let's include them in food stamps or let's include them in Medicaid. That's not something that the White House can do on its own or turn around on a dime on. So what they came up with instead was that they tried to create this private sector partnership between Jet, which is an e-commerce platform that a lot of people may be familiar with, this place where you can order diapers online, and this big network of nonprofit diaper banks around the country, which donate diapers to low-income families, and a couple of diaper companies. And they all got together and they said, you know, let's try to do for poor families what they can't do themselves and enable larger organizations like nonprofits to buy cheap bulk diapers online to sort of enable them to have the kind of savings that middle and upper income people with an Amazon Prime membership can have. And then, you know, once we make diapers cheaper for low income or for nonprofit organizations to buy, then they can donate those to low income people. So, you know, instead of the government directly enabling low income people to buy them, the government has organized nonprofits to get together with the private sector to get diapers that can be donated to them.
It is really a fascinating subject, and I'm so glad that you wrote about this because I think it is one of those items that a lot of people just kind of take for granted and don't think much about. But in fact, who would have thought the diaper is so, you know, fraught with so many issues? So thank you so much for joining us today and for breaking all this down. We will keep our eye on Washington Post's Wonk blog for more about this and other very important topics. Emily Badger, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking all about how Weight Watchers has been cited for a really poor financial performance lately after bringing Oprah in. But you know what? It may not be all Oprah's fault. It might have a lot to do with the technology of the app. We're going to talk about that when we come back here on 720 WGN. My friends, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Thanks for tuning in with us today, this lovely Saturday. And by lovely, I mean kind of gray and a little bit chilly. Nonetheless, I thank you for spending your time with us. We have much to discuss on the program. And right now, we are joined by Meg Graham from Chicago Tribune, who wrote a really interesting story. I recommend you go find it at chicagotribune.com. Check this out, because there's a lot of interesting information in it. But let's talk through it. Welcome to the show, Megan.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Gladly. Thanks for joining us. Okay, so you wrote about how Weight Watchers has reported some lower numbers. And a lot, I mean, I think anecdotally, a lot of people are blaming Oprah for this because everyone thought it was going to be all about the Oprah effect and everything she touches turns to gold and is wildly successful. And in fact, when they started turning in a little bit lower profits than perhaps, or revenue than perhaps we thought they would, everybody kind of questioned that. But with a deeper look, it looks like it's really maybe not about Oprah, that it's really about some technology changes that were just not quite user friendly. Break it down for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So absolutely, Oprah had a huge effect on people were talking so much about her. She tweeted, I lost 26 pounds while eating bread every day, and people mm-hmm. were really excited. Share prices kind of skyrocketed for a little while. But around the same time in November, they started rolling out a new app and then also a new diet program called Beyond the Scale, which basically changed the way that they were measuring points. Obviously, Weight Watchers is, you know, you measure points. Something might get 2 points or 6 points, depending on how healthy it is. And they changed the way that those points were calculated. And at the same time, this app was rolling out, and it just, people were really upset because it was deleting recipes and maybe their points were being, you know, not calculated the same way from the website to the app, and the app was just clunky. So people were really upset.
I think there was a really interesting thing that you noted that is so intuitive, but you spelled it out so perfectly in this piece, Meg, and that was how the more personal the use of an app or a service is, it seems like the changes go over worse and worse.
Totally. So, I mean, if you think about something that you use multiple times a day, so ideally, if you're, you know, a Weight Watchers user, you're using this app every single time you eat. So you want it to be something that makes sense to you, that you enjoy using. And if it's something that you get frustrated using, you're not going to want to use it. I talked to someone who has been on Weight Watchers for 4 years and was telling me that eventually she just gave up on it. She just uses it by hand. She literally uses a journal to go in there and write down all of her points because the time to figure out and navigate the app is so frustrating that she said it's just not worth it.
And in fact, there were some inaccurate calculations going. So people were attaching their wearable technology to record activity levels, and it wasn't calculating that correctly, if at all. Sometimes points were being added up wrong, things like that. And now we're at a point where we're looking at a class action lawsuit against
Yeah, there's someone filed a class action lawsuit in early February, and that's kind of ongoing. So we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, people were saying, you know, I enter it in my website and it gives me this many points, and I do it on my app and it's double that. And that's just not the kind of experience you want to have when it's something that's as serious as your health, right? These people see it as something as you know, kind of a lifeline. Like, they want it to be accurate and they don't want it to be, you know, giving them a ton of different values and confusing them on a daily basis. And then, yeah, they removed a couple features like integrating a scale. There used to be a scale that you'd literally step on. It would connect with your app and say, congratulations, you lost 10 pounds. And it doesn't do that anymore. So Weight Watchers has said it's working on reintegrating some of those technologies and adding back in some of those features that are gone. But some people have said, you know, too little, too late, I'm out.
You know, I think it's another one of those, if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of things. And it also seems like that's a lot to ask of users at the same time, to a new program, new app, new user interface. That's a lot of change at one time. I mean, if you think about how angry people get when Facebook changes its logo or the algorithm of the news feed, you know, people get really bent out of shape about the littlest thing. That's a lot of change to throw at somebody all at once, especially, you know, I think our food is so personal, and mm-hmm. and I think if you're using this app and using this service, then, you know, that's if it would, I'm sure, feel like a personal affront of some sort of, and be super
totally.
Frustrating to encounter that.
Yeah, I talked to one gentleman who makes healthcare apps. He's a doctor, and he said, you know, there's so many ways that you can do this gradually. You can, you know, release, you know, a few different iterations that each make gradual changes. You can give users an option of reverting back to an original version, or, you know, you can use usability testing and beta testing so that people can give you the feedback and tell you, you know, this is awful. I don't want to use this. I wouldn't use this. And Weight Watchers said that they did that. But a lot of people have said, how could this have possibly been beta tested because it doesn't, you know, work for me.
Right. So do we think that, in fact, the Oprah effect maybe took the edge off this negative backlash, that it would have been much worse had Oprah not been involved right at this time?
That's a really good question. And I don't know. I mean, a professor I talked to from Kellogg said, you know, you want to bring in people when you have something that's going to delight people. So to bring this, all these changes in right as you have this, you know, great effect from Oprah, who knows? I mean, it would be interesting to see what would have happened if they hadn't had that huge bump from Oprah.
It's interesting because she does not tend to stick with things that have a bad rap. So it will be interesting to see if she even stays around through the tumultuous part, or if she's like, you know what, this is weird, I'm out. I don't want this kind of tarnishing my brand at all. So that will be
absolutely
very, very interesting. Well, Meg Graham from Chicago Tribune, thanks so much for joining us, and have
thank
yourself
you
a lovely Saturday.
You too. Thank you.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news with Bob Kessler here in just a bit. And then when we come back, we are talking about those zombie real estate projects that are just sort of sitting around town and no one really knows what's going on with them. We're going to talk about some of the biggies when we come back on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us on this fine Saturday. Appreciate you spending your time here. My friends, there is still so much to cover here on the Business Lunch because there's just so much business going on in the world. All right, so you know those projects that are just sort of sitting around the city? We kind of don't know if they're on or off. These buildings that seem abandoned or seem like maybe there's activity, but then they seem abandoned again. We call those zombie projects. And here joining us now on the phone, oh, we just lost him, looks like. He hung up on us. I was going to say Ryan Ory is here from Chicago Business, but maybe he'll call us right back because he was going to talk with us about these, about some specific ones that seem to have a lot going on, a lot to talk about around the city. Particularly, we were going to talk about the old post office. This is a particular interest to me because I used to live overlooking the Spire site. So I'm fascinated by on-again, off-again, on-again, off-again real estate projects because I just think that is incredibly, incredibly interesting stuff. So hopefully we'll get Ryan Ory back on the phone here in a bit, and we will be talking about those real estate projects because there's so much to them, really. There we go. There he is. He's back. Thanks, producer Dan Long. You're the man. Hi there, Ryan. Are you with us?
Yep, I'm here.
There we go. All right. Ryan Ory is joining us now from Chicago Business, from Crane Chicago Business, rather. So you can check out this story. It's at chicagobusiness.com. It's all about these zombie projects. So as I was saying, as we were getting you back on the phone, I'm particularly interested in this because I used to live in a spot where I was overlooking the Spire site. And I was endlessly fascinated by its on-again, off-again, foreign owner, local, domestic owner, you know, on-again, off-again status. And so these projects that you have written about at chicagobusiness.com are of particular interest. I think the one probably on everyone's mind, though, is let's start with the post office, because that's this huge structure. We see it every time we hop on 290 right there in the West Loop. And so what's the status of that? Because it's very complicated by some international business rules.
Yeah, well, there's definitely some parallels to you what you just mentioned about the Spire. Foreign developer, kind of mysterious to a lot of people in Chicago, and that one's kind of been a never-ending saga. It's been taking a lot of twists and turns, and even since I wrote this story that on the zombie projects, now there's been a new development where another apparent buyer has popped up, and so it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. It's a New York-based investor that owns some pretty well-known properties in Chicago, including Aon Center and Prudential Plaza. So we'll see how that goes, because the city also has been making noises about, you know, taking the property from this current owner by eminent domain. So
Right. It seems like Rom wants no part of this foreign owner. He's like, no, this is, nah, give me that. Give me that. It seems like Rom has no patience for all of this. But as you note in the story, which I think is really interesting, what would be required to make this really work and make it become a thing instead of just a building sitting there? Because as you remind us in the story, there's been a couple of fires there. I think there was some water damage at some point. So it seems like it would need a couple of very, very big, you know, like anchor leases to even get a construction loan to do something with it. So how likely do you think it is that a developer could even get that far to get those big leases and those big tenants in there?
Well, that's been the challenge. It's been empty for 20 years because of that, since the post office actually moved out, or the postal service moved out. And it can be, I think it can be done, but when you're talking about a more than 2.5 million square foot building, you know, that's been abandoned for 20 years. That's probably going to need some structural work. It's not a simple thing to start up. So, they'll probably need multiple very large leases to get started, which makes that one particularly challenging. But the upside is it's a very interesting building. It's huge. It's right. Everybody knows it. Mm-hmm. People drive underneath it every day. It's on the river. So there's a lot of great things about it. It's just...
It's just kind of a beast that just kind of needs some
tending. It is a beast. It is a beast. And you know, it's also kind of remains to be seen. And, you know, these potential buyers are doing their homework on this, but how much work the building is going to need just structurally after sitting empty that long. And as you said, there's been, I think, 2 or 3 fires there. You know, other issues. So
yeah,
the challenge.
So there's another property that you wrote about in this piece at ChicagoBusiness.com that's really interesting. It's the A. Finkel and Son steel site, because as you note that where it is, it's kind of surrounded by Lincoln Park and Bucktown, but you refer to it as a once in a generation blank slate on the north side. So it's huge. It's a big, it's 40 acres of undeveloped riverfront land. And it looks like there's some potentially some zoning changes on the horizon that could free that up to do some other things with it.
Yeah, so it's been it was the first planned manufacturing district created in Chicago that this property's in, and these were created to prevent encroachment on, you know, manufacturing jobs from other, you know, residential and commercial development, things like that. And now there's 15 PMDs. None of them have ever been unwound. And so right now, you're limited in what kind of things you could build on this site, which has now been demolished. It's just wide open land. It is a blank slate, but it would definitely require some sort of zoning change for a lot of the potential uses that would be, you know, put to use there. And, you know, a lot of people have argued, including the alderman that the property sits in, that the PMDs are outdated, and nobody is going to put, you know, thousands of manufacturing jobs right in the middle of, you know, some of the most densely populated areas of the city ever again. And it was interesting that the alderman did come out and say, you know, he thinks the PMD should go. And the city's kind of made a few rumblings to that effect, and that's the first time that there's ever been any sort of indication that the PMDs could be vulnerable, that zoning could ever be undone.
Mm-hmm. That is really.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on that one. I think another one that you wrote about that is really interesting. You also wrote about the Resmar site, but also the South Work site, because it was one of the most ambitious developments ever planned in Chicago. And what was proposed was 13,000 homes, 17.5 million square feet of commercial space, and a 1,500 slip marina down at the former South Work steel mill site. And suddenly, U.S. Steel of Pittsburgh and a development company just kind of said, you know, we lost the fire. We don't really have this. But nonetheless, here's this unbelievable, colossal, you know, area. And after 12 years working on it and you know, this $4 billion project that was proposed, they're just kind of walking away. So do you get the sense that someone else is going to swoop in and do something with that?
Well, that one's going to be sort of along the same lines of the challenges we were just talking about with the post office. It's going to take just a huge amount of leasing to even justify starting something of that size. Mm-hmm. There was a commitment for a large Mariano's grocery store to go there, And something of that size would be big enough to kick off a lot of types of development. But in this case, you know, those numbers you just cited, you're basically looking to create almost a new city within the city. And it's going to take more than one big grocery store lease or one, you know, a couple other leases. It's going to take a lot of, you know, a lot of commitments ahead of time to yeah. even justify starting a project of that scope, you know, dollars wise, acreage wise. And so that's going to be a big challenge. And other people have made the point too, that site's biggest is challenged more than the other three because of it's farther, it's fairly far from downtown. A lot of these other ones are either downtown or on the north side where there's been a lot of development activity happening. And this one's a little more isolated and it's a tougher sell to potential residents there, businesses that would, you know, open there, and that sort of thing.
And it seems like less accessible by public transportation, which is always key to that sort of thing for sure.
Right. I mean, they have extended Lakeshore Drive essentially to create a new access point for this and to help this happen someday. So it has gotten that help. It's very big. It's very complicated. And, you know, as you said, it sounds like U.S. Steel's kind of appetite for doing this right now is diminished. And it's going to take probably, you know, some other big developers stepping in and being willing to spend a lot of time and money and, you know, potentially decades figuring this out.
Sure. I mean, it certainly would be, you know, an amazing source of revenue once finished. But I think it would, you know, as you're saying, it would take so much money. I mean, they were proposing $4 billion project. I don't have $4 billion. I don't know about the rest of you, but I think that's big, big money that not a lot of companies have
yes.
sitting around, particularly construction and steel. You know, after the recession, I think that's hard to come by $4 billion. And then as we're sitting here counting down the clock here, and we're going to have to say goodbye here in a minute, but you also note about the Resmar site in the South Loop, which is kind of interesting because it's a riverside parcel, and it stretches about a half mile south from Roosevelt Road and kind of connecting it to Chinatown, so everybody can kind of envision exactly where that is. But there's some activity there, but it looks like zoning changes are kind of what's needed to make that sort of work.
Yeah, well, not only you know, just like zoning changes as much as it probably take the city's you know, being willing to spend some money and create some infrastructure, because it's, you know, there aren't right now, there's this gap between, you know, the South Loop and Chinatown all along the river there, and you need roads and, you know, sewers and, you know, just all kinds of infrastructure that doesn't exist right now. It's also below, the site is below street level at Roosevelt, and so, you know, you're kind of dropping down below, and so it's going to probably take the city being willing to create some infrastructure to connect it, and then a developer, you know, which we mentioned the story, Related Midwest, which has done some very large projects and is definitely a capable developer, then being willing to, you know, make a huge investment and create a whole new, you know, again, almost like a small little city within the city along the river.
Right. I think that would do so much, though, to connect Chinatown and South Loop. That would be, I think, such a benefit to both South Loop and Chinatown, in addition to this new area. I mean, that would be huge opportunity there for sure. Well, everybody, go to chicagobusiness.com and check this story out, because there's a lot of interesting detail. And I love the way you broke this down, Ryan, of kind of what it'll take to kick off, your over-under to start construction, and then you have an expert opinion on, you know, what it would really take, what's involved, and kind of some really good insights there. So everybody, go check this story out. Ryan Ory, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Amy.
All right, have a good one. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're talking about that auto grat. You know what that is? It's that 18% gratuity will be added to parties of six or more. That's kind of at the bottom of restaurant menus. We're going to be taking a look at that, because there's some controversy swirling among that with restaurant employees. So when we come back, we're talking all about that here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for spending your Saturday with us. As ever, still tons to get into. Up next, we are talking with Whitney Falloon from Eater.com. Thanks for joining us, Whitney. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, Amy?
Great. Well, so there's a story on Eater.com that I found very, very interesting, and it's all about how servers are petitioning employers to bring back the automatic gratuity. We've all seen that on the bottom of menus, right? Some restaurants say 18% gratuity will be automatically added to parties of six or eight or whatever or more. And,
right.
And a lot of people, I think, just kind of accept that that will be there. But there's been some controversy swirling around that. So break that down for us and tell us what's going on.
Right. So the auto gratuity, like you said, everybody's seen it at the fine print at the bottom of the menu. That's basically the restaurant's way of ensuring that large parties don't undertip their staff. Obviously, 20% is the accepted standard amount to tip for good service these days. But, you know, for whatever reason, there's people out there that don't adhere to this for whatever reason. When servers are taking care of a large party, they typically can't serve any other tables, meaning they're very dependent on that one party to tip them fairly, hence the reason for the auto gratuity. But at the beginning of 2014, the IRS changed the way that they classify wages that come from those automatic gratuities. And that was their way of, you know, this crackdown they've been trying to do on people who underreport tip income. So under the old system, auto gratuities were classified as tips, meaning they would be paid out to the staff nightly, and it was up to the servers to self-report them to the IRS. Under the new system that started, again, at the beginning of 2014, auto grats are classified as service charges, meaning that they have to basically go through the restaurant's payroll system so they can be taxed, and then they're paid out to the servers later on their paychecks. But because of the sort of big hassle and increased cost of dealing with this, a lot of restaurants, including a lot of big national chains, have elected to just do away with them altogether. And basically, the servers are saying, you know, this is having a really big effect on their take-home pay. According to a survey of chain restaurant workers done by a site called coworkers.org, which is what we cited in our Eater story, employees at places like Red Lobster, the Cheesecake Factory, big chains like that are saying that their weekly pay, they're bringing in anywhere from $50 to $200 less per week than they were when the auto gratuities were still in effect. So they are petitioning their employers to please bring those back for them.
Wow, that's significant. I mean, I have waited tables myself, and those big parties are, you know, they're a big deal, and, you know, you need them. And it was always good when you, because as you said, you usually can't pay attention to other tables. And so it was always really good when it went really well with that table and they tip you a little above that because they were so happy. That was always a nice thing. But
right, absolutely.
So what I'm reminded of, though, is that it was kind of a similar situation with credit card tips, right? Because that usually that was automatically counted. You know, and when you had to claim at least 10% of your total receipts for the night. Sometimes, if all of your tips were on a credit card, sometimes you would end up claiming a lot more. You know, you would have to declare 30% of the receipts that you rang for the night or something like that. So, is this similar to how it's taxed, or is this a whole different bracket?
Yes, it's similar to how it's taxed. I mean, the automatic gratuities are classified as a service charge, so it's slightly different. But yes, it's all just part of the IRS's effort to crack down on underreported tip income, which falls under that same umbrella of credit card tips.
And so, as these as workers are petitioning employers to bring this back, and we should note that not all restaurants have done away with it; they're just some. But as we see employees petitioning to bring it back, do we feel like they're getting any headway with that, or are the large chain restaurants just kind of ignoring that?
It's hard to say right now. I haven't seen any, you know, major statements come out from the chains responding to this, but given the media attention that this issue is getting right now, I'd say you can probably expect some statements to be coming out soon. But, you know, the whole thing just really fuels the bigger debate that's been going on over the past year or so, which is, you know, should restaurants do away with tipping altogether? Is it an outdated sort of cultural tradition that we need to get rid of?
Right, which we have talked about on this program a couple of times, and once to great debate from callers. People had really strong opinions on that. It seems like as cities are starting to experiment with that, we'll probably see soon enough if it's a worthwhile endeavor, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Danny Meyer, who, of course, is the New York restaurateur that sort of made, you know, major industry waves when he announced he was getting rid of tipping at all of his New York restaurants, you know, says he's had really great success with it lately. You know, customers are seem to be pretty on board with it, although it takes some getting used to. And they're saying that the servers are actually bringing in the same, or in some cases, even more money than they were before when they were relying on tips. So it's definitely a complicated issue, and it's a debate that's only going to continue to get more heated as time goes forward.
I've heard a lot of conversations kind of around just the labor part of it, of a lot of people being very, very much in favor of it because it allows the servers, allows the workers to have a more dependable and predictable income at a time when, you know, sometimes you can just be cut because there aren't enough people in the restaurant. They'll start sending servers home to keep their labor costs low. You know, the nights that you do end up working, you have a lot more predictable income outcome as opposed to, man, for some reason tonight I just didn't make any money. And then some nights you make a ton, right?
Right. And that's, you know, one issue where a lot of servers are against getting rid of tipping because, yeah, you might have those slow nights, but then you might have those, you know, crazy awesome nights where you get like a $500 tip. So, but, you know, there's another issue here, you know, fueling the debate against tipping is the major issue of disparity in pay between the front of the house, you know, the servers, mm-hmm. and the back of the house, that is the cooks. You know, when you're talking about a fine dining environment, the servers might go home with $300, $400, $500 or more in a night. And then you have the cooks in the kitchen who are responsible for putting out that great food, you know, that's getting these great tips. And they're making, you know, maybe $12, $15 an hour max.
Right.
So the getting rid of tipping would go a long way towards helping sort of smooth out that disparity. So
certainly. And it's I'm really glad that this conversation is happening so broadly right now, because I think a lot of people hold servers responsible for things that have nothing to do with servers, and sometimes hold the, you know, don't realize the kitchen is making what they're making, and, you know, don't necessarily have a concept of what server base pay is. And so I'm happy to see all this transparency as someone who spent a lot of time waiting tables in her life. I'm really, really happy to see all this transparency around it, because I think it's making people think a little bit differently about how they're behaving in restaurants, how they're spending, and how servers are treated and everyone else in the restaurant.
Absolutely. And, you know, the very nature of a tip implies that it should be voluntary and given to reward good service. But the way that minimum wages are set up in this country, you know, tip workers in many states, they only earn $2.13 an hour, meaning they really depend on those tips to make a livable wage. And in that sense, the burden of paying your employees fairly, it's passed on from the employer to the customer, which, you know, frankly seems totally unfair. Who should decide your pay? Your boss that sees your performance every day, or a table of strangers, you know, that you wait on for 2 hours one night?
Right, exactly. What a great, great point. Whitney Falloon, thanks so much for joining us. Everybody, head to eater.com and read more about this issue as it continues to unfold. Whitney, have a great day.
Thanks, Amy.